Hello, I'm James Sandy, and this is the New Curiosities Box, an intriguing cloud in the skyscape of arts and culture from Birmingham and beyond. In this show, we consider identity of future and past as we speak to Andrew Jackson about his current exhibition of photography exploring the 70th anniversary of Windrush at MAC Birmingham. We mingle with those braving rum and reflection at the exhibition's opening night. We take on the perils of establishing a penal colony and the challenges of nationhood by way of a conversation with the cast and crew at Our Country's Good as it invigorates the stage at the Rep. We get poised for the forthcoming delight that is the Forwards Project with help from Bobby Jane Gardner, and we flag some up-and-coming dates for your diary. If you would like to catch up on any of our shows to date or contact the show with an idea, go to www.switchradio.co.uk/James Sandy, or you can check out our full archive at www.kingofthebuttons.co.uk. We start with From a Small Island, Andrew Jackson's current exhibition of photography exploring the psychological impact of migration through the Windrush generations, and resident at MAC Birmingham until Sunday, the 8th of July. First, some context. I'm joined by Andrew Jackson, and we're here to talk about his exciting exhibition, From a Small Island. That's it. So, Andrew, let's start with the title, which I think is a kind of clever title, because we're talking about Windrush, essentially, and we'll perhaps define what we mean by Windrush, and I think that means lots of things to different people. But yeah. The small island, I guess the first question is, are we talking about Jamaica? Or are we talking about the UK becoming smaller?
I think it's both. I think, you know, initially, obviously, the starting point is Jamaica, that small island based on small population. I always kind of find that Jamaica is a country which punches so much above its weight. And, you know, the fact is a small population of 2.5 million people is known around the world. You know, comparable countries around the world, you know, they're not in that cultural kind of consciousness. But I think it was interesting that I spoke to a diplomat out in Jamaica, and she spoke about its people being its greatest export. And these people go out into the world and they tell the world about Jamaica. They share their experiences, they share their cultural experiences, they share their music. But also, I guess, quite telling for the Jamaican government is that those people also send back revenue to the country. So it's, I guess, a win-win for a country, which perhaps might be struggle with its own economy. You know, people leave, problems leave, and yet money gets returned to the country. But also, I guess, obviously, it is a play in words in that they also landed in a very small country. And I guess perhaps post-Brexit, it might be even a smaller country.
And that's really interesting, because that taps on, I think, some central themes in your work and in the exhibition, which is really around, I suppose, identity and about citizenship. When I hear the word Jamaica, I think of two things, probably. I think of colour in the sense of the flag. Okay, I can picture the flag very clearly. And Bob Marley. You know, those are the readily available things. But there's much more to that identity. And that's probably a good time to bring in the Windrush aspects. Folks that don't understand that term, how would you describe that?
Well, I guess the term comes from the name of the ship, the Empire Windrush, which landed at Tilbury Docks in 1948. And it's important that we celebrate the Windrush as that first, I guess, post-war wave of migration of people from the Caribbean, principally black people from the Caribbean into Britain. But it's also important that we don't forget that black people have been in Britain for centuries, from the Romans. Initially, I guess there were large Tudor black populations in Britain. Not long before a few weeks before the Windrush docked, more black people left England who had been demobbed from the army, who had served from the kind of Caribbean countries, served within the British Army and Air Force and Navy and so forth. The Windrush is seen as that, I guess, that line in the sand which talks about the official start of that wave of Caribbean migrants. Who, I say Caribbean migrants, but in the eyes of the law, they were British citizens.
So there's something there also about, like Brexit itself, an event describing potentially an impact, but also defining, or beginning to define a generation, because obviously the Windrush
describes people from, you know, we're a second, third generation now.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's more than just the boat. People think, oh, it's a one-off event. Mm. But there's actually a lot more in terms of the impact on our culture. For me, I think one of the things is often forgotten, and I'd be interested in your perspective on this, is perhaps the journey of those communities before they even got on that boat. You know, some of those folks, how they got to Jamaica is what I'm touching on. So there's a whole heritage that perhaps is...
Historically, you know, there was the transatlantic slave trade, where, you know, one of the tropes I was interested within the work was to create a series of seascapes. You know, the sea is so important to Jamaica. The sea is where people were brought beyond their will from Africa to Jamaica to populate the plantations. And the sea is also where large majority of those who left Jamaica left from. The sea is such a powerful, it defines Jamaica. Sea in one sense, it obviously makes an island if it's surrounded by water, but the sea is a potent symbol of migration, and it's economic migration, because people were brought there to make money for the empire, and they left again perhaps to furnish the coffers of the empire by working in the factories of Britain after the war, I guess.
And there was something there, I think, about hope. Okay, so a lot of the work and a lot of the photography you're exhibiting, I think, does an amazing job at capturing hope and aspiration. I think that really, really comes through. I think the other thing is expectation. And what I mean by that is partly it's about what will happen next and where people will go and integrate and develop. But also there's something very clever about, I suppose, the nostalgia, if you like, at the time of making that journey and the hope of what that might bring.
I think... You know, going back to the image of the sea again, what the important thing about that is there's an element of adventure. For, you know, we're talking about young people who are in their late teens, early 20s, and, you know, the sea in one sense denotes or asks that question of what is over that horizon. And my parents both grew up, like, you know, their generation, with the notion that they were British. You know, they were socialised to be British, they were educated to be British. You know, when there was a king or queen's birthday, there was celebrations. When they went to the cinema, the national anthem was played and they stood up and respected that national anthem. My mom, she collected a scrapbook of, you know, cut out images of the princesses, Queen Elizabeth and Margaret. She had, you know, she wanted to see Buckingham Palace. So it was almost in one sense they thought they were coming home by travelling. But also there was that sense of adventure. They were young people. They wanted to see Britain. My mom had this misapprehension that she'd come to England and she ended up in Warsaw, that she would see the Trooping of the Guard and the men in their red tunics walking through Warsaw and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a romanticised impression of Britain, but that was the impression that they were sold by those who told them that they were their betters, I guess.
So that's interesting, because that almost, I guess in some ways that developed a sort of a mythology in some ways, didn't it? A kind of, you know, a very set image of almost a kind of perfect kingdom, if you like.
It was, but there was also within that equation that the British were also gods, godlike in one sense, and that they were better than, they were the best people in the world. Because that was how they were socialised. And it was interesting that the first day that my dad found himself in England, he'd flown, he was fortunate enough to fly, and it was like various different stops, and he found himself in Greenland at one point, because that's the route he took. And he tells me about standing there, in this kind of a hall with all these world clocks underneath him. And when he eventually landed in England, he found himself at Victoria Station, and he saw these two men stealing the shoes of this drunk who had passed out. And that vision challenged all of those years of being told that the motherland was this mythical and wonderful place of gentlemen and chivalry, and these were the betters who were helping, guiding the Commonwealth. And then you land in England and you see a drunk being robbed of his shoes.
That's another trajectory, I think, that the exhibition and your photography captures, which captures well, is that very stark realization that, you know, the first generation, if you like, of the Windrush generation, encountered prejudice. You know, they not only were the myths dispelled, if you like, or, you know, the kind of expectations a little bit, you know, they fell short, to say the least, but there was that instant kind of prejudice for different people and you know, not just different looking people, but different sounding people, different cultures, who interestingly had, to that point, you know, as you mentioned, always perhaps looked up to that cult, you know, this idea of the culture of the motherland, you know, that's a kind of an idea, isn't it? So how have you, you know, in terms of your photography, how have you explored some of that?
I guess I was interested in creating images which perhaps had a sense where the people within the frame had a sense of introspection. And there was also, I guess, for me, because what part of the work was for me to go to Jamaica, which was for the first time for me to visit Jamaica, to explore how my perceptions, I guess in one sense to test the validity of my perceptions of Jamaica. You know, all of my life, my stories by my parents had shaped for me a perception of Jamaica. And so me actually visiting the physical spaces was a way to test out these memories. And, you know, these memories had, in one sense, my parents' stories had created me. They, you know, I'd use that as a foundation for who I was. At times when I questioned, when my sense of belonging to England was challenged by people, I'd often return to Jamaica as a space to shore up my identity. And so actually going to Jamaica was a way, within this photographic work, was the way to explore what my perceptions of this space were. And I guess in one sense that the images, I ended up finding that I was quite dislocated from these spaces. They weren't my spaces. You know, I was British, I'm British. And as much as I might have lauded and championed my Jamaican identity, legally and in other, you know, other forms, obviously I'm English, British. And as soon as I go to Jamaica, people quite forcibly tell me, you're English, you're not Jamaican. And so the work, I guess, the spaces, there was a certain dislocation, both from the people within the frame, but also the spaces as well.
There's quite a clever reversal about that, if you think about it. So if you think, you know, going back to your father at Victoria Station, seeing the shoes, in some ways, you know, doing the same in reverse. Was there a moment where you thought, oh, actually, you know, those kind of, those supporting stories, as I was growing up there, you know, sort of jarring of...
Well,
you know?
I think even maybe as a child, you kind of realise, ask the question, well, if Jamaica was so fantastic, why did you leave? You know, if you're such a idyllic paradise and it was wonderful and your childhood was fantastic, and why did you leave and why didn't you go back? But you know, the when you're a child, there are certain questions you can't ask your parents. But you know, in reality, their lives are so much better in England. Opportunities, they're able to, you know, buy property, there's full employment in ways in which there wasn't in Jamaica. When my parents left, there's both, you know, political instability, people were becoming, you know, wanted their independence from the Commonwealth, from Britain, which they finally got in 62, and there was violence, there was unemployment. So suddenly there's an opportunity arises where the motherland is asking for your labour back in England. I guess you take that, A, for the opportunity to advance your position, but also for that venture, but finally, I guess, because you want to see the motherland.
And we've seen in recent current affairs, you know, recent news stories about particular folks from that generation, from the Windrush generation, almost being forced into kind of proving themselves and proving who they are. And, you know, some really harrowing stories about people who, you know, have attempted perhaps to find out more about their past and kind of been locked out of their future in some ways. So how would you say the exhibition helps tackle that, you know, that current sort of, you know, topical dynamic, if you like?
I think the project started off with me wanting to create a legacy for my parents, to memorialise their experience. You know, my dad was seriously ill in 2010, and I'd realised I hadn't really photographed my family in a serious way. You know, the friends were dying and passing away, and there's a realisation also that their histories and their story, the history of that generation, were fading away. I knew that there wouldn't be any memorials or plaques on walls to celebrate their arrival, And I saw that, you know, this perhaps, you know, taking his photographs and undertaking his project was as a way to, I guess, yeah, indeed, to leave a legacy for their presence here and prove to the world that they existed, they lived here, they are a part of Britain, and they helped, you know, advance Britain in that sense.
I wanted just to finish to talk about you and your photography and how you got into photography. Okay. And, you know, I guess the young Andrew picked up a box brownie. You're probably not that old, well, but, you know, picked up a Kodak camera kind. Or
I guess I got a Kodak Instamatic camera for Christmas. My sister bought it me. I was quite young. Suddenly you get given this box, and then maybe on one level you realise it comes with certain benefits. Suddenly you're the centre of attention. You have a certain power. You can get your dad or your mum to look this way, look that way, stand on one leg, turn around. You know, you take photographs, suddenly people say nice things. But, you know, maybe on one level I kind of was seduced by, you know, the certain powers which the camera could give you. But there's also one incident when I guess I'm a small child, I woke up and I heard crying outside of my bedroom door. I opened the door, I walked onto the landing and looked down at the bottom of the steps. My mum was crying. You know, I just kind of watched this from a distance, and after a while she walked away and she left an email letter. And there was a little Polaroid picture in the picture, and I kind of, you know, looked around the corner to see if she was there, and I took it out. And it was a picture of a grave. And what happened is that her brother had died in Jamaica, and nobody told her that he'd died or been buried. And her stepmother had just sent her a picture of his, you know, grave and his Polaroid. And I kind of thought about, you know, this small square piece of paper has his power. To make somebody cry, has this emotional, you know, kind of effect on a person. And I remember being intrigued by that for many years. But it wasn't until I was doing a business course at Dudley College. I'd kind of messed up my exams, if I'm honest with you. And that was one of the few courses I could get into, and I was doing it. I had no interest in it whatsoever. And I found myself skiving off in the library, and I found an old British Journal of Photography annual. And there was a work of Nick Hedges in there. He'd done a series called Born to Work. And I just found that a powerful body of work. Both my parents had worked in factories. My dad worked at Goodyear's, and he talked about how hard it was and how difficult it was. But it wasn't until I saw these images of people working in industrial environments that I was able to visualize that. And I thought, you know, photography had this power to convey these messages to other people who weren't there. And I ended up finding out that Nick Hedges was subject leader of Wolverhampton University, and I did a degree there under Nick Hedges, and
And you've done some amazing things since. I mean, you've won several awards, and you're working in New York. And
I was lucky enough for this particular project. I did a residency in New York, which was awarded to me by Autograph Association of Black Photographers and Light Work, and I was their nominee, and I went out there and worked with a master printer to produce the images which were in the exhibition.
If folks are interested in your work, they can come here to MAC and see the exhibition From a Small Island, which is here in the First Floor Gallery until Sunday, the 8th of July, people have got plenty of time, no excuses to miss it. Andrew, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
You can visit the exhibition as part of MAC's Windrush season until Sunday, the 8th of July, in the First Floor Gallery, and entry is free. For more information, you can call 0121 446 3232 or visit macbirmingham.co.uk. More now on Andrew Jackson's exhibition From a Small Island, as I caught up with some of those attending its opening night to get their take on this moving reflection of change and identity.
Okay, so Annette, we're here at the exhibition. Can I just get an idea of your sort of reflections, your thoughts on some of the photos?
We knew straight away when we walked in the door, my sister and I, that they were Jamaican, because we're half Jamaican, and we lived in Jamaica for a very long time. So a lot of the images we knew, and we also felt a little nostalgic, I suppose, and you could see the nostalgia in the pictures. It was very obvious that there was a loss, and you could see that in the faces of, especially the last one that we're looking at here. So, pretty much.
Are there particular scenes or items that remind you of Jamaica? Or?
The schoolgirl was the one of the first ones. She was from Trelawney, and we lived in Montego Bay, which was very close. And she had a badge on called the Quarry House. And for us, that was Donald Quarry, who was the fastest runner on Earth, until, of course, Usain Bolt took over. So we were both in houses at high school as well. So it was nice to see it.
There's some really powerful images, and one that really stopped me in my tracks, I don't know if you've seen it yet, but it's one of the sea, just the open sea. And I've never been to Jamaica, but it just, I don't know, there's just something about that kind of expectation.
I've seen many seas.
Yeah.
And sea is always comforting, but it wasn't the first one that jumped out for me.
Okay.
I think there were many others. There was this young boy in Kingston, in a very rural part of Kingston. I think that was quite powerful. But I also loved the words on the wall that we stopped and read, and that sort of gave a flavour of what we expected to see here today.
Okay, and are there other bits of the season, of the kind of programme of events that you're going to be dipping into in terms of the things that Mac have got going on?
Well, there's a couple, and I would have loved to have gone to the Windrush one tonight, but it's been sold out, so we're going to keep an eye on it. I've signed up for the newsletter, so hopefully, yes.
Excellent. Well, I will allow you now to enjoy the exhibition, but thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
Bye.
So, Judy, here at the exhibition,
yes.
Tell me your sort of instant sort of reaction thoughts.
Very colourful and very wanting to go to somewhere hot. That
yes.
was my first image. The image of the sea that I see right in front of me, it's just so peaceful and calm and beautiful. And then you've got palm trees, and they're very much alive. It's been a while since I've seen colour photos, because you know black and white has this tendency to just look good anything. So it's really refreshing actually to see some colour photos, and they're really cool. It's captured some great moments.
And there are some, I think, I would call them hidden things in some of these photos.
Yeah,
so you have to kind of look at them two or three times.
That's right. So
what about your perspective on, in terms of Windrush, and how something like this helps people get a better understanding, better awareness of Windrush and the Windrush generation? That's a big question, I know.
It is a big question. You know, in that era, people were going in search of something. And that something could have been anything. It could be escaping from a place, looking for something new, a new adventure, a possibility to live and to survive, you know. And many people across the world live their own kind of Windrushes. I've lived in other countries, and you hear stories, people immigrating, the Italians who immigrated all over the world. In that time where people were looking to build the world, and there were things all over the place to go. And I think we will come back to those times where our young people are going to have to venture out to other places to be able to survive.
It comes at a really interesting time, doesn't it, in terms
it really
of
does.
Questioning our identity and where we are in the world and
right.
where we've been as well. And I think
right.
yeah, there's some very old questions that have come round again.
They have, but the truth be known, you know, we're part of the earth, aren't we? We're a living being, part of the earth. And if we just had more love and respect for one another and for the earth, I think we'd already be in a better place. And people would be so much more peaceful if life was fair. And we should be able to make it fair. We're in the 21st century. And the things that are happening in the world, it's like, wow, history just keeps repeating itself. Technology's gone so far ahead, yet still humanity. It's kind of like still stuck in the caveman, isn't it? And that's men and women alike.
That is a very powerful message, so I'm really glad I picked on you now. So.
Thank you, Jay.
Thanks for your time, thanks.
You're welcome.
So Charles, you said your name.
That's great.
It's a proper name, isn't it, Charles?
Oh, yeah, very old-fashioned Western.
Wow, okay.
We're appropriating.
So Charles, tell me initially what your reflections are of the exhibition.
It's nice to get a contemporary view of what part of the Caribbean that, you know, is looked upon quite nostalgically.
Mm.
But at the same time, you know, you get a feel that things are very different to the way that maybe your parents or your elders would have told you what back home was like.
And are there things that strike you initially, kind of things you recognise or things that maybe challenge you a bit?
Nothing surprising, but I think actually some, particularly in the corner over here where you get a sense of people ageing, becoming more infirm, and you know, that's kind of interesting for me from a personal perspective. I'm going through exactly the same thing. Right. So elderly parents, you know, stuck in their homes, that kind of thing. And it's quite vibrant, that idea that that exists in this kind of what looks like an island paradise in some of the other pictures that you see.
And do you yourself have a Windrush connection? Is there a strong link? Or?
Well, my link is simply through my parents. My parents were that generation, and but I was born here. And, you know, I see myself as Black British. My roots to the Caribbean are incredibly thin, very frayed. They're only alive through my you know, elderly parents, aunties, uncles, and my grandmother who's still alive.
Wow. So there's a really interesting, I guess, dynamic at the moment around identity and citizenship and where we are in the world. You know, and do you think something like this helps explain that, or does it confuse it?
Well, I think the jury's out. For me personally, I just feel comforted that, you know, whilst at one end it's a nostalgic trip through, you know, that part of history and where we are today. At the same time, when you look around you and the people are here, it's an incredible mix of people, a mix of cultures. And, you know, at the end of the day, we are one culture. And, you know, if we can respect one another, that reinforces my sense of identity rather than confuses it.
I will second that, and I will end by asking you an unfair question, which is, have you got a favourite yet? Have you got a particular
I've only just begun, yes,
well,
as the song goes.
I will let you carry on and enjoy it, but Charles, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. So I'm with Simone and Lisa, and we're having a good look at the exhibition. Are there things that instantly strike you about the exhibition? Things you?
The first thing that I found interesting as soon as I walked in was that this space is usually not very multiculturally held. So what was amazing for me was to see it was representative of Birmingham, it was multicultural. Lots of aspects of the exhibition resonate.
It is a real snapshot of Birmingham here, you're right. I noticed that when I came in, there was a real mix of people. Simone, what about you?
You've got
a lovely umbrella in your hair, I should mention.
Thank you.
As well.
I just think it's being an artist myself and a designer maker, I think it's fantastic to kind of see it through different media. So you've got photography, you've got everything, you've got sculptures. So that's what really makes it really unique and enriching experience as well. And it's cross-generation as well, it's educational. We need more projects like this in Birmingham. That kind of shows a rich history of Birmingham and WST as well.
Do you think people know enough about the Windrush? Do you think they have an awareness of what it is?
No, I don't think they do. I think kind of like my parents are from that, their forefathers are from that generation, and they educated me about my history. But I don't think enough is being done about that. Obviously, in the news, like, you've got the negativity at the moment, what's happening. So maybe it's raising more awareness. So anyway, even though it's really grotesque, it's kind of good that we're having those discussions, those conversations. So now I think it's still kind of, you know, pretty much not an unheard of concept really for a lot of people, which is a real shame because, you know, this is we all made, this amazing country, so it should be represented in our history.
That's a very powerful comment, I think, there. Are there other things throughout the kind of Windrush season, Matt, are there other things you're going to dip into? Are you going to do any of the dancing and the music and that kind of stuff? Very important part of Jamaican culture, if not wider.
Yeah, I'd like to see, I think they've got a really good dance on here, but it's sold out, so I'm not going to get a chance to see that at the MAC. But no, not really. I mean, kind of like, I'm lucky to have had those conversations with my gran, who's passed away, what was like when she came here. So I think, like I said, we need to have more of these conversations taking place and raise more awareness of that, really, because we are part of the history here. So.
Well, excellent. I shall let you now enjoy your rum-based cocktail.
Thank you.
With your cocktail umbrellas proudly in your hair, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm joined by Trevor, and Trevor, you're enjoying a cocktail.
I am, definitely.
Which is allowed.
Thank you.
Yeah, you are allowed. I'm just really interested in your reflections on the exhibition and, you know, and the season itself about the celebration of Windrush.
Yeah, well, I'm excited. I haven't even started looking around as yet.
Oh, I've caught you early.
You've caught me very, very early. But yeah, but what I can feel, it's a good vibe here. So a lot of people mingling and whatever. But yeah, it's going to be, looking forward to it.
And yourself, do you have connections to the Windrush generation?
Yeah, my parents originally from Jamaica, yeah. Came over in the 50s, yeah. So just to hear what they've experienced and just to see in photography what they've experienced. Yeah, so looking forward to it.
And when you were growing up, how did your parents describe that experience? What sort of things did they say about Britain and the motherland, they called it, I think, didn't they?
I think that their very first experience of coming into Britain was obviously the weather. Obviously,
yeah, it's always beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, always. But yeah, obviously they found, when they first arrived here, they found it difficult even to get housing and things like that. So, but obviously they've come through, they've lived their life in Britain and now gone back to Jamaica. Yeah, so.
And when you were a little lad, as it were, did you have a sort of a fixed image of what Jamaica was like? Was that the other way around? Was it a kind of idyllic place or?
To be honest, being born in Britain, it was hard for me to sort of see what was happening in Jamaica or sort of get an experience of it. But over the years where I've gone to Jamaica and experienced it for myself, it's a beautiful country, absolutely. And sometimes it staggers me to see why they left such a wonderful country to come to Britain. But obviously, economic reasons, I'm sure, yeah. But yeah.
That and the weather, I think.
Yeah, the weather, oh God, mentioned. Without the weather, oh yeah.
Okay, Trevor, thanks for that. I'll let you enjoy your rum cocktail.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All the best. Bye-bye.
Cheers, thanks. So, Josh, you're at the exhibition. What do you think? What do you make of it all?
I think, well, basically, our family's from Jamaica. And, I don't know how long ago, but they probably would have been caught up in the slavery. So, I think that all races should be treated the same because we're all human. So, yeah.
Are there particular images or pictures that stand out to you that you think, yeah, I like that, I recognise that, that's familiar? What do you think?
Well, kind of like the ones with the uniforms, and I think they're really neat that instead, other people would probably not really dress up that neatly, but these people are all neat and everything, so yeah.
Excellent. And what do you think about the one of the sea over there that we can
it's a beautiful picture.
Ahead. Yeah. Apparently that's Montego Bay, apparently.
Yeah, it looks really nice. It's a good picture.
And is photography something you've done or you're thinking about doing, or maybe this makes you think about doing it?
I do a bit and my dad does a bit as well. It's really interesting as well.
Excellent. Now, important question, have you had a rum cocktail? No comment, I think that is. Okay, well, I won't ask you anymore, but thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
I'm with Tony Kelly, who I think is an old acquaintance of mine in some ways.
Well,
our paths have crossed, haven't they,
yeah,
Tony?
Indeed, it has. In a good way, yes.
Uh-huh. And Tony, let's just start with your reflections on the exhibition. What sort of things have you seen?
Right. Well, it's reminiscent of my past. I was born in Britain, although I have a Jamaican accent. But at an early age, I was sent to Jamaica by my parents and stayed in Jamaica until I came back here in 1979. And all of the scenery, the photographs, the pictures that have been taken, I'm going through them and seeing Kingston and seeing Montego Bay and all these other places, the sea, the sand, and various images of people. It really brings back home and thinks, oh my gosh, I need to go there quickly. We were last year, my wife and myself, 2 years ago. But it's well captured, the essence, the detail in the photography, the imagery, the visual effect, everything about it comes alive in the photos. This is a small version in terms of telling you what each photo is about. But I'd encourage people to come and see this exhibition. Really is good, highlighting the Jamaica, every aspect of Jamaica in terms of the culture, the heritage, the people. It all comes alive. And it says from a small island. I have a bit of doubt about the title. I know there's the Greater Antilles and the Lesser Antilles. Jamaica is one of the bigger islands in the Caribbean. So I wouldn't say from a small island, but I suppose it's tongue-in-cheek why they put it in that sense, Andrew Jackson did. But a marvelous exhibition. I'll have to bring people. I have some friends coming in from New York in mid-May, and I'll have to bring them here to see, plus the other exhibitions that are on with all to do with the Windrush. And it's apt and appropriate, especially when we think of what's been happening over the last few weeks. It's been happening for a while, but it's only just come into the public domain in Parliament, and the press media have taken it on big. You can't have people who you've invited to this country, like my parents were invited as the Windrush generation, to come here, and suddenly they're in no man or no woman's land. That's terrible. And I'm glad that they've decided we've got to put it right. And it couldn't have happened at a better time when the Commonwealth Heads of Government Conference was being held in London. And ideally, Theresa May, in the first place, she said she wasn't prepared to meet them. She quickly changed her tune because it's a very, very serious issue. You can't displace people like that and expect them to just survive. We're sending them, deporting them, putting them in detention camps and so on. And the emphasis, they are not illegal immigrants. There's a clear distinction, a line of demarcation. They were invited here. They've helped to build this country. And this is a classic example of somebody showing, having come from poor beginnings, humble beginnings in the Caribbean, in Jamaica and other islands, and have come here to build this country. They should be honored, they should be respected, they should be valued for their contribution made. This has sort of given me a more positive approach, because I was angry over the last few weeks watching the television news, the media, and all the sad, really horrible stories coming out. But this restores your faith in human nature, seeing somebody showing their skills, their talent, bringing it to the fore. And I urge people to come and see this at the market.
Tony, great to catch up with you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
And now a modern classic focused on crime, punishment and rehabilitation by way of Our Country's Good, playing at the Rep Birmingham until Saturday, the 2nd of June. I took time to explore the themes and the innovative production with Associate Director Simon Startin and cast member Kieran Hamilton-Amos.
I'm here with Kieran Hamilton-Amos and Simon Startin, and we're going to talk about a really interesting production, I think, called Our Country's Good. And that's an ambitious title to start with. And to set the scene a little, maybe Simon, you can help me first. This is something set around, I suppose, late 18th century.
It's 1787, so you're exactly right. It is the time when the first fleet travelled to Australia, which had been discovered about 12 years previously. And they travelled there with the express purpose of setting up a penal colony. And that's why we believe that the Australians essentially are all descended from convicts, which isn't true, but that's the kind of myth, because essentially the first Australians, a high percentage of them, were convicts sent from our British justice system. So they spent 8 months on the ship, and then they landed in around the area of Sydney is now, and they started a colony. And so it proceeded from there.
So the setting really is the kind of first British convict colony.
It's not the first, but it's certainly the one in Australia. They had convict colonies in America beforehand, mm-hmm. but yes, Australia, this was the purpose. They went to Australia and thought that's a great place to send the prisoners, and they did so.
And a great situation, I think, to kind of explore a number of wider themes. Now, Kieran, let's bring you in at this point. Now, you've got a couple of roles, I think.
Yes.
In the production, you play Caesar.
Yes, Caesar.
And Faddy, is that right?
Yeah, Lieutenant Faddy.
So tell me a bit about those. So that kind of, does that mean you're on both sides of the counter in the production?
Yes, to an extent. There's like three sides of the counter. There's like the convicts, the officers that kind of want the play to happen, and then the side that Faddy's on, which is, you know, prisoners are prisoners and should be treated like prisoners. There's no rehabilitation, it's punishment. Mm-hmm. So Faddy just takes the standpoint, which is completely opposite to Ralph Clark, who wants to put on a play for the prisoners to do. And he sees it as a way to, I don't want to give too much away, but he sees it as a way to, you know, get up the ranks. But through that, he develops and realizes that these prisoners are actually human beings with stories and feelings, and Faddy's just kind of opposed to that. So every, you know, well-worded speech that Ralph says, Faddy just throws a little curveball in there. Yeah, whatever. Just throws those across the table, which is good. And Caesar is a Madagascan man who was taken from Madagascar to England and then from England to Australia. And his journey through the story is because he's from Madagascar and he's black, he feels slightly ostracized from the rest of the prisoners as well as being ostracized from the officers. But by being involved in the play, he kind of integrates and they become a real community and a real family. So that's the arc of his journey, I would say, yeah.
So given what you've told me so far, you know, it's clear this is a crime and punishment story. I mean, that's kind of, I guess, an obvious thing. But there's something in this which is interesting, I think, about origin in terms of how a group or a community is established. And there's a kind of clever play on that, I think, in terms of some of the theme.
Well, indeed, because you've kind of got the imperial might of Britain trying to set up a colony according to the British laws and according to very strict military lines. And then you've got the contrast of them deciding, or the head, the Captain Philip, the character who's in charge of the whole colony, decides it's a good idea to redeem the prisoners by putting on a play, and they get something from it and they might grow from it. So you've got this contrast between a very regimented, you do as you're told, you will do go where you're told at all times, and this more kind of communicative, kind of liberal view of the world where we try and communicate as human beings and work together. So there's a kind of negotiation and a battle between those two ideas throughout the play, and that's sort of how the community might be formed along one of those two lines. And is in the balance which way it will go really during the course of the play.
So it's in a way, I mean, the way I kind of read it is that, yes, they're rehearsing a play, but it's almost like they're rehearsing the kind of foundations of a country.
Yeah.
They're rehearsing how it might look and how it might might fit.
Well, the skills that you might put on a play, which again is about treating each other humanely and with respect, are perhaps going to give the prisoners the ability then to buy into a bigger project of Australia and a bigger idea of being governed by agreement, that they agree, they sign up to it. Rather than being forced and scared into some particular role, they're governed by agreement. And the theatre is sort of a training ground for that larger skill base. Whereas there's lots of officers on Faddy's side, for example, who would say, they need to learn how to do as they're told, to farm, to build, to work. And why should we put on a stupid play? Which, you know, that argument still continues today. Yeah. So,
and there's also, I think, a balance in this around what some folks would call Stockholm syndrome. You know, people might be familiar with that, which very briefly to describe that is, I suppose, people justifying the actions of their captors. You know, they kind of, they assume a culture and justify it, whether they've challenged whether it's right or not. Are there questions around that, perhaps?
Yes. Yeah, I think for both the officers and the convicts, there is always that question of, and the development of the question of, is what we're doing the best way of doing it? Because it's an option to take these people to Australia. That's an option that was a choice there. There's an option of putting on this play, and then we start to see the humanity again in each other. Not just officers seeing prisoners, but prisoners also seeing officers as real people, as potential love interests. So I think by the development of the story and having the vehicle of the piece of theatre, it's allowed both parties to kind of look upon and start to think about their actions, their conduct, and it gives them a sense of empowerment and purpose again.
There's a line in the play which Liz Morden is one of the kind of principal characters we follow through the play as a convict, and it's a story about her redemption as much as anybody else's. And she says, if they say you're a criminal, then you're a criminal. There isn't any argument about it. And that, yes, I think you're right, they have internalized some of those ideas in themselves, so they think of themselves that way. But if by putting on a play, they think realize they've got more quivers in their bow, sort of thing. That's the wrong metaphor, but you know what I mean. And they grow and they learn to see themselves differently, and that's probably the first step towards their redemption, is not just everyone else realizing that they've got more skills, but they themselves saying, yeah, I can do this, I'm not just a criminal.
Let's talk a bit about some of the, what I would call the language of the of the production. And I think I might use an expression, physical language. Whether that means anything to anybody, I don't know. But what I'm trying to get to is there's a very clever use of signing and of captioning. Yeah. And I think really that touches on accessibility, doesn't it?
You know,
it's kind of trying to make the production as accessible as possible. But beyond that, it kind of uses it as a... As a fluency, as a language within itself.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There's the access side of things, which allows some of the performers to communicate with each other through British Sign Language if they're deaf. There is also the audience, deaf members of the audience, and I know Birmingham Rep and all the theatres we've toured to have done a lot of work of developing those audiences who might not normally go to the theatre because they're not being served to... up until now, so they come into the theatre. So there's the access, but then this access, this means of communicating, has an aesthetic, has a beauty, is a toolkit for making theatre.
Yeah.
In the context of this play, then yes, the convicts communicate with each other secretly. There's almost like a spy system that goes through the colony of being able to communicate outside the offices, which is unique to this production. That's certainly a really nice discovery. And the process of making theatre with a group of people who are of disabled and able-bodied, as we actually ourselves have gone on, is a process of negotiation and adds to the kind of meaning of the play and the humanity of the play, that we learn to listen to each other, we make allowances, we compromise, and that's kind of, so it has that, just that simple means of communicating has really grown its roots right into the play, which is lovely.
So Kieran, as an actor, how do you approach a production like that? Because that's a kind of much broader palette, isn't it, potentially, in terms of what you might be used to?
I think it was a great challenge, and it was a great opportunity to be involved with something like this. And being an actor, you learn to love words, you learn to love language, no matter if it's, you know, written language, if it's BSL, if it's captioning, you see the beauty of it and you see the story of it. So just by being able to be around British Sign Language and having the captioning and seeing that certain jokes worked really well in BSL and in spoken English, but then some worked just in BSL. And it's just about playing all the different parts. And because of this type of show, where you can say that the play that the convicts are doing is the main character, the whole central thing, as Simon was saying, is communication. And there's so many different ways that we communicate, not just through spoken word, but in body language. And having BSL as another tool, as another character, as another life form, as another thing that we can now act through, it was a great opportunity for me and the rest of the cast. And you know, as accessibility goes, you know, theatre should be a reflection of the world, and we looked into history that disabled convicts went over as well. So this idea of having sign language and this idea of having, you know, different forms of non-verbal communication would have already been there. So it's just playing the truth of what was actually there.
Now, this is obviously a historical production, but it has some history itself, doesn't it, as a play and as a production. I mean, I think it's been in one guise or another for about 30 years or so.
Yes, it has. Yes, it's done the rounds. It's performed all over the world. It's on the curriculum here in the UK, and I think it's studied a lot by school kids all over the world. So it's a good market for that, certainly for the production, and kids really get a lot from this production and the play itself, because it's it's about compassion towards people, and that's really important. It's kind of people, how we look after each other, and that resonates right across the world, regardless of culture. And also, it's fascinating, the birth of Australia.
The production, the play, runs until Saturday, the 2nd of June, here at the Rep in Birmingham. Kieran, Simon, thanks so much for your time. Thank you.
Thank you.
For more information on Our Country's Good, go to birmingham-rep.co.uk or call 0121 236 4455.
Now we get a quick heads up on a musical ode to Birmingham through a range of upcoming live performances of new musical compositions. For the lowdown, I spoke to composer and musician Bobby Jane Gardner. Okay, I'm joined on the line now by Bobby Jane Gardner, and we're going to talk a bit, Bobby, about Forwards, which is an interesting project. I'm hoping I said it right to start with. Tell us a bit about that.
Okay, so it's a two-year music programme that I created, and it's about, it's a musical ode to Birmingham, basically. So 10 create music about the 10 Birmingham constituencies, like Sutton Coldfield, Erlington, Hodge Hill, Yardley, and so community groups. And they come from the four individual wards that make up their district or constituency. So, for example, I worked in Selly Oak last year, Selly Oak District. I worked with groups in Bilsley, Bramwood, Selly Oak, 10 composers. And then 5-6 artistic partners have to select the composers as well. Partners like Birmingham Contemporary Music Group, Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, who I work for, had support from Capsule, WASFA, Access Creative College. So lots of amazing music and arts organisations have also helped the project because it's absolutely insane. There's a lot of people, a lot of partners and, yeah, people.
I think you managed to get everyone in Birmingham on that list, so well done you, I think. So we're talking mainly, I think, about working around sort of live performances and compositions of things?
Yeah, so basically what happens is each of the composers work and collaborate with their community groups, and the remit is, at the end of that year's worth of work, they have to then back the music to or with the communities. We've got performances happening in Sutton Coldfield. We've got a dubstep producer called Podman, selected by Access Creative College. He's going to be performing at concerts in the park, actually, at Sutton Park, with the Sutton Rock Choir, who are also one of his collaborators for the Sutton New Hall Awards. And then we have in Erdington, we've got, by Flatpack Projects, we've got a composer called Scott Johansson, that's his stage name. And he's creating this moving image sound project. And then we've got in Yardley, selected by Martani, she's got with Field Recordings, and she's going to have some sort of surround sound, wonderful performance happening in a church in Yardley. And then in Hall Green, selected by Midlands Art Centre and Hare and Hounds, we've got Grandmaster Gareth from Misty's Big Adventure, and he's going to be performing in the Springfield area in Hall Green District, this a piece as well. And then we've got more in Ladywood, we've got Zosa Cole, and he's going to be performing like kind of jazz and stuff there. And then I think this is the last person, I hope so, in Perry Bar District, we've got award-winning producer Simon Duggle, who is going to be playing that music in Lazelle's Methodist Church. So all throughout June, ending on the 1st of July, we've got 6 performances, all free, members of the public. And yeah, it's a celebration of a lot of hard work.
Wow, that is such a cast of musical talent and composers. I think people listening, they'll be sitting there with their notepads. They've broken the lead on their pencil, I think, trying to write some of those things down. It should be said, I think, also, I guess the stars of this in some way are the residents and some of those community groups that you've sort of got on board.
Definitely. And there's been some really beautiful stories that have emerged from these partnerships. For example, the primary school and the project kind of served to catalyse him gaining more confidence. And he now has keyboard lessons. He writes songs regularly and has more friends, that kind of thing. And in other areas, more vulnerable groups have just said how, yeah, just how it's really supported them. Yeah, so, and quite staggering, some of the stories that have happened as, just as a byproduct.
Now, some of the things I've read that you've been up to, or some of the folks you're working with have been up to, you've been out and about sort of, I guess, taking sound clips or taking kind of environmental things from different places. Have you been hanging around in hedges with microphones? Is that what it's what it's been like?
It depends on the community group and composer, but yeah, there have been people looking at out in the woods or whatever. But it's basically the reason for the field recording is that I wanted to restrict barriers to collaborative composition, and I thought a good starting point would be for people to record sounds and listen and sonically engage with their environment, and that didn't involve anyone needing grade 8 piano or anything like that. Anyone can record sounds as long as you've got either an audio recorder, mobile phone, or some sort of device. You can listen, and as a result of those sounds that are collected by the composer, and then that kind of triggers stories about what it means to live, work, or create in that area. you know, why they come together as a community in that particular area, and then talk about what the music should sound like. It's a very much an intergenerational project. We've had rock choirs, we've had young mum groups, we've had church groups, we've had all sorts, lots of schools, and it's been amazing actually. And even a deaf group as well. So that's been quite interesting how they sonically engage with the project and how they can also compose music despite some of them not being able to hear. Yeah, quite an amazing learning curve.
It's moving towards, I think, what I will describe as a very exciting crescendo in June. And you mentioned all the see what I did there. You mentioned all the different places that you can find wonderful things going on. In terms of where people find out the details of these things, where should they go? This is the important bit people need to write down, I think.
Yeah, in terms of getting your pencils out, it's www.4-wards. That's forwards.co.uk. And if you go to the events page, you can see how to book. You have to book, even though it's free, your place, just so we know, just in terms of numbers and health and safety, blah, blah, blah. So please book your free ticket. Please support as well, because this has been such a labour of love. And, you know, the music and the performances are, you know, to the highest standards as well. So please do come and support this musical Ode to Birmingham.
And there are great things going on, I think, right up until to the 1st of July. I think that's when the last one is happening, or is right towards the end of June. I'm going to be coming on to a couple of them as well, so we're going to try and cover them through the show, which is great. But in the meantime, Bobby, Jane, thanks very much for your time, and hopefully you won't have to do too much hiding in hedges.
Between now and when we next speak.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Excellent. Thanks.
For your free tickets and more information, that website again. www.4-wards.co.uk. And now it's time to close the box. My thanks to Andrew Jackson, Mac Birmingham, Simon Startin and Kieran Hamilton Amos, Ramps on the Moon and the Birmingham Rep, Bobby Jane Gardner, the Royal Birmingham Conservatoire, 448 Creative and M7 Public Relations. The New Curiosities Box is written and presented by me, James Sandy, and is a King of the Buttons production for 107.5 Switch Radio.